Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Sculptor and memoirist Dan Corbin was born in Yuba City and grew up on a family-owned farm with 50 acres of peaches and prunes located in Sutter and Butte counties. In 1955, there was a flood in Yuba City which inundated his family's house in 5 feet of water. 38 people died, and the flood ruined the orchards. After serving the Army, he attended UC Santa Barbara on the GI Bill and graduated with a BA in art. After a year in Spain, Dan Corbin lived 4 years in Hawaii before returning to California. After 6 years in Berkeley, where he started selling his sculptures, he moved to Santa Barbara, where he studied art and wrote a screenplay. In 2012, he began writing a memoir, Kiss of the Art Gods, which he recently completed after 35 years in the art business. Dan Corbin, welcome.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So you wrote a screenplay?
I did. I wrote that in probably 1988. It was about the art business, similar to my book, because that's what I know. It took 2 years to write it. I let it loose in L.A. there. And at that time, I moved here to Chico. And that's when my sculpture career actually took off, was at that time. So I chose sculpture over writing. And just now, all these years later, I began writing and finished my memoir, Kiss of the Art Gods. It's about an art journey. It's something that, I really felt strongly about writing because the art business is not really understood. And also because, you know, Chico was such an important place for me in my development.
Well, now, you wrote a screenplay and you just said it's about the art business. So from what you've said in your book about the art business, I wonder if you would label it an expose of the art business.
You know, I would say that I got to write what I wanted to write about the art business. And some of it is really good. And I had great mentors that taught me how to fly and were agents of hope. But, you know, it's a tough business. It's actually the art industry. And, I'd say a quarter of the people in there probably need a little visit to the judicial system.
You say that in your book. But now, you mentioned this, it's a tough road, and it is amazing. When I saw, okay, here's a guy who grew up on a peach farm in Yuba City, and he becomes a successful artist, I wonder myself, how in the world did he do that?
Well, one of the reasons is because I learned a lot about beauty. Growing up on the ranch, I learned a lot about work. Most of the work is procedural work. My grandfather was a blacksmith. We had a shop. We built all of our equipment. So very early on, I had people that helped me with technical skills in the shop. And also another aspect of it is for the people that know my work, it's very earthy and it's and it has textures and those sort of things, which I gained from the beauty of the area here, being in the valley and living an outdoor life. So I would say that, you know, artists probably come from all different backgrounds, but my background as a farm kid, we called it a ranch, was a pretty good basis for becoming a sculptor.
But it's still, you can have, and you mentioned this in your book, having a lot of talent does not equate success in a field. I mean, look at all the wonderful singers, but not everybody who's a great singer becomes successful at that. And that's what was so intriguing about this journey. Here's a kid who grows up on a peach farm, and he has a successful career in art. For example, some of your clients, I mean, people have heard of Elton John.
He owns a couple of my pieces. That's right. I get asked about that all the time. I actually only met the guy in spirit because he bought him out of a show I had in Fagel's Gallery in Atlanta, and he had a preview, and he came in. She knew the guy because he only lived a few blocks away. It's really not really understandable for most people, but he actually owned the fifth story of a high-rise, and he was only about four blocks on Peachtree, by coincidence, Avenue there. And so he had a premiere of my work. Fagel brought him in, and he says, I want these two sculptures. The deal is they have to be in my condo before 4 o'clock today, which was only a few hours away. So I never got to meet him. He was going on tour and he had to leave. So, but anyway, it was a great sale. I love musicians and other artists that like my work. So it was a great sale for me. It sold out the show.
My guest is Dan Corbin, and he is a local sculptor and artist. He lives in Chico, and his book is Kiss of the Art Gods, Memoir of a Sculptor. And this title, you come back to this idea of art gods. And what is, can you tell listeners what you mean by art gods?
Okay. We'll try to do this. It was, first of all, I had to have a title for the book. And the idea that I had was that, you know, I can't really figure out what makes art go, and I don't know that anybody else knows the meaning of art. I think that art is the closest thing that we have to making it real and getting it right. And so for me, what I set up was someone in the book, a character, and they are the art gods, or a character in the book, and they help explain artists' motivations and just what art is. So the next part of your question was?
Well, this idea of art gods that you chose as the title of your book, did you consider other titles or was that pretty much it?
I had another one. It was called The Lightest Light and the Darkest Dark was an alternative title for the book.
That's one of the names of your chapters, one of your chapters' names.
That's right. And the idea on that was that, you know, right next to your brightest spot in life, you can have your darkest spot in life. So I was thinking about calling the book that. But I actually like the art gods because every time I mention it to another artist, I say Kiss of the Art Gods. They go, what do you mean by that, Dan? Do you mean Curse of the Art Gods? Because it's like something that you're born with that, I don't know, it's in you. And I kind of talk about that in the book. I just think that artists are born to be artists and that if you're going to be successful or whatever, you have to bring that out and teach yourself and have be taught by others to the best way to be a good artist.
Well, why don't you describe your cover for people who can't see?
Well, my cover was designed by Gary Blum, who actually did the covers for the News and Review probably 20 years ago here in Chico. He was a member of the studio that I was in at the time. It was called the Drive-By Studio. And he was very talented, and he's a very successful artist now, and we've helped each other out through the years. So I said, hey, Gary, can you make me a cover for the book? And he said, well, I can do that. So I chose one of my photos that I had shot in the studio and gave it to him. And what it is, it's a close-up of one of my sculptures. And, of course, my sculptures are made as though they're symmetrical. They're female sculptures for the most part and male sculptures. And I have laid symmetry and over the top of the sculptures, and within that symmetry, I divide colors up in there, kind of like a color fill painting, but different materials are also embedded in the sculptures. So it's a close-up of one of my sculptures. What else we got?
Well, the colors, you have pink and kind of a gray and various colors of this figure. And it's life-size, I'm guessing.
That's right. The pink, I'm through my pink phase. I'm through my bright color phase. I tried a lot of colors, and it almost seems as though if you're on the moment, like about 5 years ago is when I made that sculpture, and I did a lot of colorful sculptures, they just seemed to, you know, people just really loved them. And you know, now I do a pink one and nobody wants it. So I don't know what's going on with that.
Well, it's a realistic depiction as opposed to abstract cultures. Abstract sculptures.
Uh-huh.
And I think people would find that appealing.
Well, you know, that's the strength I had. I've worked from the figure since the get-go when I was in college at University of California at Santa Barbara. I studied the figure there, and it's been my center of focus this whole time. And one of the good things about coming to Chico when I came and in 88 was that the access to, you know, the model community here. And I didn't have that in other places. So that's one of the things.
A live person that you're talking about.
Yeah. And we had
pose.
That's right. We had different drawing groups. One that held were held at the say the drive-by gallery in friends' houses in the evening. So drawing is really a very important part of, you know, being able to sculpt, because all of the concepts of building a sculpture are within the drawing framework. It was a good place for me to really put everything together.
My guest is Dan Corbin. He is a sculptor, and he's written a memoir, which he calls Kiss of the Art Gods. And people might wonder, okay, what? We have a gap here between when you're a kid, you start your book.
Yes.
As you're a youngster in this flood that is devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go off to, what was your first job was rather interesting, the one you describe in the book. You go to Reno. And what did you do there?
I was a room service waiter. It was a great job. It was a great, I was 18, 19 in that age group. And my brother was going to the University of Nevada there. So he was able to, you know, land me a job at one of the casinos. And I worked my way up to a room service waiter. It was great tips. It was exciting. I liked the whole atmosphere of the gambling and all of that. It was for a kid, you know, it was pretty good stuff.
And here's a teenager delivering room service
yes.
to some lady in a negligee.
Well,
we won't even talk about that chapter.
We can't go there.
So
you can read about it, though.
So why would you give up a nice job like that, Dan?
Well, you know, it wasn't really my choice. The letter I received from Uncle Sam said, you're invited to join the service or be drafted into the service. So I was drafted in 1966. And you know, that was quite a change, and it was the Vietnam War era, and everybody was really anxious about going to Vietnam, and we were warned about it, that it was going to happen, and it just, when I was drafted, I said, well, here I am with the rest of the guys. It was kind of just a large movement of people that were going through the military at the time.
And you say large, because I was surprised, Dan, when I was reading that, the numbers of men, that young men, who were being drafted and how you were processed. And it was, and I think I'm trying to remember how you described it, not a turning point maybe, but a stroke of luck, that they have you all lined up, this huge line of young men, and the major says, okay, guys, I want you to number off 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. And why did he do that?
Well, you know, at that time, and they did it occasionally, they would draft into the Marine Corps. So they had us count off 1-2, 1-2, and I think he said, all the ones step forward, welcome, you're now a member of the Marine Corps. And boy, I'll tell you, a lot of people really didn't care for that one. Actually, I was, and it was a stroke of luck that I was drafted into the U.S. Army and went to Fort Ord to do my basic training.
So you were inches away from being drafted in the Marines.
Stroke of luck. Just, you know, it's just... you know, a lot of things in life are just luck. So, and that was one of my best days of just luck. I had no desire to go to Vietnam, really.
In fact, you say, I've had great luck in my life. And that was one instance, the fact that you became a soldier in the Army and not a Marine.
I think so. You know, I got some pretty good duty in the Army, and I caught another break. Even as a soldier in the Army, I didn't have to go to Vietnam. But that was, you know, the Army for me was actually a good experience, because it was, you know, it was a place for me to grow up and learn things and gain confidence in oneself, and also to, you know, be able to withstand all of these conditions. And I studied art in the Army. It was the first art classes I had were at the USO clubs. And I was stationed in Germany, Frankfurt, Germany. And the only thing for guys to do was to go out and get drunk or go to the USO clubs, you know. So I went there and studied photography, which I still do today. It's one of my best knowledges. I use it to promote my work, and it's really a good skill. I learned it in a dark room there in Frankfurt. Also, I had my initiation into painting classes as well. You know, a lot of soldiers did it, and I was one of the guys who took advantage of the USO club, so it was a good deal for me. Also, being in Europe, for me, was probably the genesis of, of me becoming an artist because it was just so much exposure to things that were so different than that I hadn't seen before, just the architecture and, you know, the art museums and that sort of thing. So it was a good experience for me. I didn't care for the Army overall, all the orders and that sort of thing. But, you know, now looking back on it, I have fond memories of it for some strange reason.
Well, something I found amusing is here's this kid from Yuba City, and you had been in Reno, but when you get inducted to this huge building, and I thought this was where else but California, there's this guy sitting there in a lotus position with his hands in a yoga mudra, and he was protesting. Just remind people what time you were living in then. This is 1966.
That's right.
And here you are. What did you think when you saw this guy sitting there?
You know, I just didn't know what was going on. He was protesting the war. He was trying to get out. You know, the whole time I was in the Army, people were trying to get out of the Army, you know, and a lot of, before I even got into it, people were trying various ways not to be into the Army. And one of my friends took off to Sweden. So there were all kinds of different things. But
went AWOL. He was already in Europe, you say, and he went AWOL off to Sweden when he's in Europe.
So, you know, there were a lot of people trying to get out of the war and probably for good reason. I didn't really know what was going on in Vietnam when I was drafted. I didn't have a clue. To see this guy in the lotus position, there was an officer and a couple of sergeants around him, and he was in the middle of this big room, and then we started talking to each other, trying to figure out what was going on. The MPs came over and told us to keep moving. So there was a lot of chaos at that time, you know, and there was a lot of blowback. People that didn't really want to do the war, so.
And there were huge numbers of you. Again, that's what I found surprising. I guess I'd forgotten that. But, Dan, you were such a good soldier that they say, Dan, we want you to go to officer candidate school.
Well, you know, I had a little problem in high school when I first started, but I got, you know, towards my senior year, I started to get better grades, and then I went to a Yuba College for a semester or whatever. And, you know, I think I was coming around at that point and probably could take a good test, you know, and so they actually pulled me aside along with 10 other people and said, okay, you know, of all the people here, you're the 10 guys that we want to send off to officers candidate school. Of course, they consider different things, you know, PT test and all these different tests you took. And I said, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm willing to give Uncle Sam 2 years.
And that would have extended your time in the Army had you gone to officer candidate school.
Yeah, that's right. They want you to spend another 6 months. And plus, when you get out, you're on call as a reserve for, I don't know, maybe 4 years. Someone would know exactly what that is. But so I turned that offer down. It was, you know, those guys were really going off to Vietnam to become platoon leaders and, you know, lead squads out into the jungle and stuff like that. And even though I was a terrific
lifespan
hunter
of about 5 minutes.
Yeah, you know. they shot those guys first. So, yeah, it wasn't something I really wanted to do. I just went through as a draftee and took what they gave me.
My guest is Dan Corbin. He is a sculptor and a memoirist. He's written Kiss of the Art Gods. And he's describing what it was like to be drafted into the Army in the mid-60s. And you do have touches of humor in your book, Dan, and one that I was tickled about. You go in, because when you go in the Army, they want to shave your heads. And so this barber leans down and says, make sure you don't pass the infantry test.
He said, make sure you flunk the infantry test.
Right.
So, yeah, that's what he said. That was pretty good. I didn't know what it was about. And about the second day I was taking the test, there was a part, you know, that they had for the infantry, maybe 20 questions or whatever, and it said, what is a bazooka used for? Living outdoors, or is it used for mashing potatoes, or is it using for blowing up tanks? And I said, well, there it is. There's the infantry test. So, I mean, the Army and all of its...
So I'm curious, what did you say? It was for...
I don't know how I got into the offers. They offered me to be an officer because I flunked that thing. I might have answered one of them right.
So they
probably said, this guy's smart enough to flunk the infantry test.
Oh,
this is the guy we want.
So,
I don't know. I don't know how that worked.
I just wondered if you on purpose didn't pass the infantry test.
I didn't pass it.
So you followed the barber's advice.
I did. I followed his advice.
But you did, I thought it was very interesting, you did get to learn Morse code, and it was very intensive studying. In fact, it was so intensive that you were hearing these codes in your shower.
Well, you can imagine. day after day for, I guess it was 6 months, 4 hours a day listening to code. That sort of thing all day long.
Well, now, did you just say something in Morse code just now, or is that?
There are two or three letters in there. I was trying to get my old call sign in there, but I don't quite remember it. But, let's call Morse code override. I was just taking a shower, turned on the shower head, and the Morse code was coming out of the shower head. It was just like, it was all over the place. So, and in conjunction with that, the other 4 hours we spent learning radio teletype, which was one of the, at that time, was the height of technology. And so we had to be able to do both, because the idea is that when I got my final duty station, I was in a headquarters company. We had engineer divisions below us, and the communication that I was trained for was in case of war. So when you go out, the thing that works the best is Morse code, because it'll cut through any static and bad weather and everything. And if it's a good day, you use teletype. And, of course, it's all encrypted. And part of the people that work with me were code people that would encrypt it and give it to me, and then I'd send it.
And I want to remind people the times there. When you're doing this, you're in Germany, and the U.S. is afraid. Who are we afraid of? Who is the enemy? Why were we preparing for possibly a war?
It was a big, bad bear. It was the Russians. It was all about the Russians. You know, we were in Germany, and of course, everybody that knows that period of time, there was an Iron Curtain that ran through what, Berlin or whatever, and
there was an East Germany and a West Germany.
That's right. And we were in the West, which was free, and then in the East, they were communists. So, you know, and there was a big fear, and that's the reason when I was in Germany, there were actually 500,000 troops there.
That's staggering.
I know. That's a lot of men with nothing to do, I'll tell you. We found things to do, though. and in Vietnam, I believe that year that I was there was 67, the first year I was there. There were only 400,000 in Vietnam, so there were actually more soldiers watching communism in Germany than there were in fighting it in Vietnam.
I think that would surprise people, because we know about the buildup in Vietnam, but you're saying that there were more U.S. soldiers actually in West Germany than there were in Vietnam that time.
I looked it up. I wanted to make sure I got the facts mm-hmm. right, and when I looked it up, that's what it said. So. Yeah, that was the case. We were occupational force. We were helping them get back on their feet, and we're making sure Germany didn't overrun them. So we weren't very. We just had numbers there as far as being efficient at what we did. It was a Will Ferrell comedy, really. I mean, people were wrecking equipment. It was just like it was a big pork barrel of waste, in my opinion. But, you know,
a lot of reading done, didn't you?
Yeah, we got reading done. You know, we got.
What was your favorite thing you say in your book? What your favorite was reading material was?
Well, I started out with just popular novels like James Bond, stuff like that, and then branched out to other things. So I didn't have any really big literary background or anything there. But.
Well, I especially enjoyed your time, your description of your time in Frankfurt, because I happened to have been a young person in that city that same year that you were there.
Well, there we go.
So I knew, yes, that's the way it was then.
It was really exciting for me. The German people were still dealing with the aftermath of the war. You could kind of tell, like I was saying in the book, that there was some sort of a cloud over them or something like that. And, it's something they've gotten over now, of course, but they treated me really well, and I had a great time. And it must have been a hard act to pull off, to have all of these young soldiers running around in your country and you're trying to get back on your feet and all this stuff. So, yeah, it was an interesting time. I enjoyed it.
My guest is Dan Corbin, and he is a sculptor, an artist, and he has written a memoir, Kiss of the Art Gods. And what provoked you to want to write a memoir, Dan?
Well, the first thing is, I don't think the art story has been told the way it should be told. And I wanted to tell it the way I've lived it and the way I see it. And there are a lot of memoirs written by artists, but, you know, these are the kind of artists like Eric Fischel, who gets $1 million for his paintings. Well, that's not really like most of us in the art industry, which are maybe there are 100,000 of us spread across the country in all these little towns. And our experience is that we just get by, you know, and we're doing our thing. And, you know, the celebrity memoirs are more about naming names and that sort of thing. It's not about actually the day-to-day struggles and, you know, the things that you come across and things that you need to learn and people you meet that change your life and those sort of things. So that's what I want to bring to the memoir was my experience and tell it the way that it happened to me. There's other situations that came into me writing the memoir. I'm getting older now, so I really wanted to get it done and get it out there.
Well, perhaps one reason we don't get memoirs from sculptors or musicians because they have already an art form to express themselves through their music or through their art. And yet you have this talent for writing, so you can express yourself both through your sculptures and the written word, as we might call it.
Yeah, that's one of the things there. One of the things that I haven't been able to do with my sculptures is when I sell a sculpture and it goes to Elton John, well, it's put in his house. And then I'll sell another one to like a Supreme Court justice or something, and it goes into their house. And then I'll sell it. Most of the people that buy these sculptures are wealthy, powerful people. And that's the way that it's set up is because they're so expensive, so hard to make, that only the people that are at the upper echelons can own the work. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to write something and get it out to college students. You know, the people are thinking about becoming artists, and there's no real guidebook for people to, you know, how do you do this? You know, how do you navigate this system? Because when you graduate, you're usually just given a degree and out the door you go, and you don't really know what's next. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted just to have something that and express my viewpoints through literature about the art business. So people can buy it for $20, under $20, you get it. You have something that can go to just the average Joe.
And I'm sure the art students' parents are sitting home and thinking, oh my gosh, you want to major in art, but what about your student loan? How are you going to support yourself with an art major? Well, I do want to take a break, Dan, and I want to hear, we have you in Frankfurt, and you eventually get out of the Army, but it was a very interesting way you exited the Army that a lot of people don't know about. So I want to ask you about that after the break.
Okay, we'll do.
My guest is sculptor and memoirist Dan Corbin, and he has written a memoir, Kiss of the Art Gods. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is sculptor and memoirist Dan Corbin, and he grew up on a peach orchard ranch in the Yuba City area in the 1950s. He worked out of a studio in Chico in the 1990s, where he began making a living from his art. He has specialized in creating life-sized sculptures of the female form and has been represented in galleries across the country. So we have been talking about the fact that leading up to this successful art career, you were a young man in the Army in Europe, and it comes time for you to, you've served your time in the Army, and you chose a very interesting way of being discharged.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I really enjoyed being in Europe, and I had met this guy that was, He was some sort of a kind of like a spy guy that had dual citizenship between the U.S. and in Germany. And I said, well, and he's married to this German lady. I said, well, how did you pull this off? You know, I mean, what did you do? How did you get here? How did you get this job you have? And he said that he took a European discharge. And I said, European discharge? Now, what is that? And he says, well, you get
a European discharge as opposed to the normal discharge. Like, you come back to the States. That's what you're expected to do. You're over there. You come back to the States and are discharged here in the United States.
That's correct. And so I went to the clerk's desk there, and I talked to the company clerk, and I said, do you know anything about a European discharge? And he says, well, not really. I never heard of it, but I'll look into it. And, well, a week later, I had the papers, and I got discharged in Frankfurt. And boy, I sure made a great exit, too. I'll tell you, I had my backpack packed, and it was morning formation. I waited until they're all out there in formation. I'd say maybe 300 or 400 guys out there, you know, and I just walked right out of the concern with free man. So anyway, I traveled.
Well, they lost your file. I thought that was what? They found his file behind a cabinet?
Well, you know, the Army is snafu.
I think people have an idea of what that means.
Yeah, you don't have to snafu. And, you know, they lost. I was a holdover in Georgia for 3 months picking up cigarette butts. I had other jobs, too. I was a fireman and whatever. But there were guys over there, seriously, that were holdover companies that were 250 strong. Guys had been there for 6 months, longer than 6 months. And that's all they did all day was pick up cigarette butts. The only way to get out of it.
Because they were looking for stuff. They didn't have enough for you guys to do.
There was nothing to do.
Nothing to do. So.
The only way to get out of the holdover situation was to volunteer for Vietnam. They'll cut you a new set of orders. And, you know, there weren't a lot of people that took them up on that.
You certainly didn't.
I did not. But anyway, so back to Germany. When I was in Germany, I went to Spain because I had been there before.
So you get the discharge. You get the European discharge. You got your backpack. How are you going to get to Spain?
You just get on a train. It's really easy to do there. And, you know, by that time, I like traveling and getting out and everything. By that time, I'd been around to different places there, so I knew how to use the train system. So I went to Spain, and in high school, I had learned a little bit of Spanish, so I could speak a little Spanish. And I bought a motorcycle and just took off from there and went down the Riviera, up to the Swiss Alps, down into Paris, got one look at the riots, got out of there, went to England.
Don't rush by that, because this lets us know this was 1968, May of 1968. Paris was in turmoil. The students were rioting, turning over cars and burning them. I mean, you don't mention this in your book, but I happen to remember that year 1968. So you land in Paris in 1968. You seem to have a knack for that, Dan, of being where the action is in your life.
I've had a few really coincidental things happen to me. But I think that anybody that travels or moves around a little bit will have coincidental things happen to them, you know. And I was thinking about that. I said, well, there's two or three things here that were pretty interesting that happened to me. But it was only because I was going to school in Santa Barbara, or I was living in Berkeley, or I was traveling, you know, in Europe, or living in Hawaii. I mean, because that's, you know, you meet interesting people when you travel. That's one of the things about that I love so much. And I think Nancy would agree to that.
You know, traveling
is you know, eye-opening, and it's really exciting. And you do meet interesting people. So anyway, let's see.
And especially if you can understand their language, because so many of them I've found are anxious to talk to you about, well, for example, in France, a bookstore owner that wanted to talk about politics, and I felt like not a victim, but she had a somebody she could tell spout her opinions, which she was a delightful person.
Well, so how much French do you speak?
Je me débrouille. I get by. In Spanish, too. So it really... adds to the fun. I happen to love travel, but you have had quite a series of adventures. So you have your motorcycle in Europe, and you travel around Europe, and this is 1968 when you get your discharge.
That's right. Early
April. You land in Paris it had to have been May when the riots were going on.
Probably right in May, yeah.
And you say, okay, I don't think I'll stay in Paris. And then what did you do?
Well, I went down to the coast, down to the channel, and took a ferry over to England and stayed in London for a few days. It was just absolutely beautiful there. I mean, it was just exciting. They speak English. They drive on the wrong side of the road.
That was scary, Dan. When you're talking about, you're on a motorcycle, and they're driving on the, what did you say, wrong side of the road, Dan?
I think on the left.
Or they would say, we drive on the wrong side of the road.
Well, whatever it is, it's really hard to do on a motorcycle, I'll tell you, in busy streets in London. But, you know, when you're young, I guess you don't care. I was actually a pretty good driver. So, you know, it was all fun. It was adventure.
So you, after being a cog in this military system, mm-hmm. and you do give credit for the USO for giving you a chance to practice and learn about art.
I didn't have a class in high school. My parents wanted me to go to college, you know, so it was, they wanted us to
don't
get
waste
out.
Your time on art, Dan.
You know, kind of the... well, it wasn't even mentioned. I didn't even get a chance. It was just, you know, well, my older brother was quite a star in school, I mean, in terms of just academics and all of that, and turned into an attorney. And I guess they thought that I was the same kind of guy, but, you know, we're a lot alike, but a lot different. Mm-hmm. And so it just wasn't for me at that time, college and those kind of things.
My guest is Dan Corbin. He was born in Yuba City and became a successful sculptor and now has written a memoir, Kiss of the Art Gods. And one thing I enjoyed at the end of your chapters, Dan, you write kind of, well, here's what I learned, some musing, some observations. And so when you have done all this traveling in Europe, what did you learn about yourself?
Well, you know, what I'm talking about in the book, Kiss of the Art Gods, which is my memoir, and it's about the art journey. So what it was for me is all of these things that I went through, the army, working in Reno, growing up on the farm, all of these things, I try to equate those to making me into a sculptor and how they influenced me. And so at the end of the chapters, what I try to sum up is, you know, this is what I got out of the army. I learned how to deal with all kinds of people. I learned how to, you know, study art. I was open to new things and saw that there were a lot of different ways of looking at things. And I think you have to have all of these kind of balances if you're really going to try to represent human emotions and those kind of things, and that it all comes out in the wash when you make a sculpture. If you've learned the things and it becomes part of you, and then you can put it into a piece of artwork. So that's the reason I try to sum up, because the story is kind of, some people might think it's rambling, but all of these experiences that I had ultimately made me into what I am today, and that's a figurative sculptor.
Well, one sentence that caught my eye in your book. You talked about the themes and patterns in your life, mm-hmm. because I also focus on that. And I started a memoir I don't know how many years ago, and the title of my book was Patterns, for that very reason that you mentioned in your book, these themes and patterns that appear in your life.
You know, I think if you're gonna write something, you have to tie it together, and you have to have a fabric, and, you know, and themes. And for me, it was, you know, just how did you get to where you're at, and how are these experiences that seem so vast and different and everything contribute? And at the end, how do you pull it all together? And I think that's part of writing a memoir is, you know, you write it in three parts, and at the end you pull it together. And so, you know, that's what I attempted to do is at the beginning of it was rough drafting it out and putting all of the scenes that I thought were really important and fundamental for me. And, you know, writing a memoir is a hard act. It wasn't easy for me because I didn't like getting into all the emotional things and, you know, digging up the backyard and finding the bodies buried back there and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you don't dodge those things. You aren't always complimentary to yourself, Dan.
Well, you know, that is the genre. You know, if you're going to write one of these things, I didn't know what it was really. I had read a couple of memoirs, and I didn't really know the genre that well. I was just kind of reading just random things. But my editor told me, he said, look, Dan, you know, you got some good stuff in here, but you really have to start digging out the feelings and the emotions and all that and put those into it. And I said, you know, my nickname is, you know, Fort Knox and the Mystery Man.
How are you going to open the vault?
Yeah, how do you open up the vault? And I think the only way that I've been able to do it is because it's not like telling somebody something. When you write it in a book, you have space or distance because you're not, the reader is reading it and they understand that it's a book and it's literature and that sort of thing. And I think it was, that's the only way that I could do it, was I couldn't really do, tell the things, they're so personal that you have to, because people know what's real and what's not real.
My guest is Dan Corbin, and he has described his life as an artist. And I think of an artist, Dan, as maybe mild-mannered, creating beauty. And yet there are places when I'm, you're a tough guy. You're not above beating somebody up. You get mad at them. And you at one point list all the broken bones you had.
Well, you know, here's kind of a blessing, and I don't know if it's a blessing or not, but I'm half Yugoslav and half Irish. And that combination right there, you know, when you put that together, you really have an explosive kind of situation. And it's been something that has been in my family, you know, that we have, you know, to bring it in and to focus that energy. And that's,
and yet you have a brother that's a lawyer, Dan.
Well,
and you're,
you know,
beating people up.
Well, the thing is that he came in really handy because he was a defense lawyer. And so the little things that I got into were nothing for him because he did murder trials and all of that. And basically he said, Dan, don't worry about it if that's all you did to the person. But anyway, if I did anything to anybody, they deserved it. Lack of payment and being, you know, just way over the other side. And I actually, at that point in my life, I used to like a little scrap here and there. And that was just, you know, one of my problems.
Well, now that would be extremely, more than frustrating. If you have a piece of artwork and you, because dealers don't have to pay anything for their inventory. So you have a piece of work in their inventory,
yes,
and you go by and it's not there.
They're not
but
there.
They have not paid you.
The red starts.
And yeah, so I think the reader would say, yeah, Dan, punch him in the nose.
Yeah, well, you know.
Because he was putting you off. Oh, no, I don't have time right now.
You know, it was just at the point that I one of the dealers, I didn't treat him so well. But, you know, it was because he was treating me badly and not paying me and that sort of thing. And I was just fed up with the art business. I said, what difference does it make? And so, you know, I think that I admit that I was wrong. And I changed my ways after my brother talked to me. He said, you know, Dan, this is not the way to do things. And so, you know, so I haven't really been engaging in that sort of thing. I got it under control. I've seen my share of people that, you know, that help out with that, you know, and talk to you about it and everything. They always let me go. They say, just work on it a little bit here, Dan, a little bit there. You'll be okay. Iron out some of the wrinkles, you know, you're okay. So anyway, I think in a book, if you're going to really talk about what happened, and I know there are 10,000 people in this country that could have written the same book as that I wrote here, that if they would really come out and write it. Being an artist is kind of an underground thing. You know, the first thing that people ask you is, well, do you support yourself? I mean, that's the first thing people, and if nobody.
A lot of us could create art, you know, we paint a painting, and but we don't support ourselves with it.
So it's the kind of thing that, you know, that, yeah, that people don't really believe. So it's kind of like, I don't know why it's so underground. There are people here in Chico that support themselves, and every little town around here, and all across the country. There, so it is an industry, and that's one of the things I try to emphasize, that the art business is an industry, and it revolves around galleries and photographers and people that deliver it and people that sell it and create it and all these different things. And it's a lot bigger than anybody would think. And hopefully, what I'd like to do is to do my little part about making sure that and getting it out of the dark and get twice as many artists in the country supporting themselves. And I think it's possible to do. I think there are enough people out there that would like to collect art if we can just clarify things for them, you know, get rid of some of the mystique and get rid of some of the art speak and, you know, just allow them to be collectors of artwork. I think there's a lot of things that can be done with the tax laws or whatever to give, you know, buyers a break. And, you know, whatever. It can be a lot better than it is now. And so this is my attempt at doing things. Nancy?
Well, I'm laughing because when you talk about art speak, you have a quote in your book. I don't know if it's word for word. It's probably something similar that you're saying, you're in this gallery with your artwork, and so you kind of sidle over to see what people are saying about your work. And there are a couple of people standing there, these ladies. And one says, archaeologically inspired with, and the other lady completed her thought, with an anthropomorphic African representation and a realistic matrilineal enactment.
Well, that's about what they said. And, you know, I don't know if she's going to read my reaction to that, but I decided to get away from it. I couldn't listen to it. It was just all a bunch of BS to me. I mean, I just make something that really feels good and been working on a system of making things. And of course, I do like a lot of things that are dug up out of the ground. So maybe she was right on that. I used a female form. I just couldn't understand it.
Well, she thought it was archaeologically inspired and with an anthropomorphic African representation and a realistic matrilineal enactment.
There you go. You
know, multisyllabic words must be impressive. But your reaction was to want to run away from that.
I didn't want to listen to it. I didn't want to listen to it because it might influence me. I know why I make them. I don't know what they were talking about, really.
Well, besides the fact that you did not meet Elton John, who bought some of your work.
No.
But you do mention a couple of names back that I recognize when you were in Reno, Al Hurt and Pete Fountain from the music world.
I actually served them. I was a room service waiter, and it was probably 9 in the morning. I think they'd probably been up all night. I don't think they'd been to bed yet. And they called up room service. I had a little room with my red jacket on, and you know, they called up, and so I went to the room, knocked on the door, and said room service, and the two of them were in the room in there, and Al Hurt, I mean, I said, okay, here we are, you know, here are the guys. And they were the nicest people in the world, you know, and Hurt gave me his shoes and said, you know, take them to the shoe shiners, you know, they know how I like them. I scuffed them up last night when I was dancing around. And, and Pete Fontaine was over however you pronounce his name, was in the corner there, and he was...
Pete Fountain.
Pete Fountain was in the corner, and he was just watching, and they were just really tremendous artists and could see through me. I was just a young kid working a job for the first time or whatever, and they start into this scat singing, you know, and pick up them shoes, dun, 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 take them out and get them shine. You know, they were still high or something. I don't know what the deal was, but it was really fun. Those guys were great. They gave me a nice tip. I met a number of different people there that were kind of like stars and stuff like that.
Well, I want to ask you about a particular, because they were past celebrities. You met somebody who was not yet a celebrity. Nobody knew who this kid was. He was an unknown. And this was during the time that you were in Hawaii. And I'm reading along in your book. I thought, what? He met, at that time, his nick went by nickname.
Well, his name was Barry Obama.
Barry Obama, before he became Barack Obama.
That's right. And he was about the puberty age. And actually, you know, I don't really talk about this to many people because, like I was telling you earlier, nobody really believes that I met Barry Obama. But the thing is that you couldn't miss him because he appointed himself mayor of the Ala Moana Shopping Center. He understood that there was power in crowds, and he was running for president at a very early age and was practicing all these different kind of things. And the one that I remember most in describing the book is that, well, first of all, I used to, every time I'd go, he was at the Ala Moana Shopping Center, and I'd head in and buy some stuff and there was only one place.
Your studio in Hawaii, by the way.
Yeah, a studio in Hawaii. It was in Honolulu. And I went to the University of Hawaii for a year. Jimmy Carter gave us an extension on the GI Bill, so I jumped back into school. And anyway, in the afternoons, I'd go into the Ala Moana Shopping Center, and Barry would always be sitting on the same bench, and he'd have his little posse with him. I always had followers. And he was the shyest kid when I first met him in the world. And so I'd come out of there, and I started talking to him just to try to, you know, get him to interact with different people. He's obviously a very unique person. He was this beautiful specimen, just physical specimen. And there's just something about him that I think most people just, when they look at him, they say there's something about the guy. But anyway, so I try to help him get out of his shyness. He was the shyest kid in the world. But I'll tell you, when he went through his puberty stage or whatever, he turned into the most overt person in the world. He grew an afro hairdo, and he used to greet people at the main double doors to the Ala Moana Shopping Center as they came and left, and he would shake their hands and press the flesh and pat them on the back and smile with his big smile. And it was the scariest thing I ever saw, really. I mean, I said, who is this kid? And, you know, what's he doing? You know, and it was apparent even at an early age that he had some drive in life. You know, a lot of people thought that he was born, you know, in some other country, and I guess Kenya or whatever, because his father was a Kenyan.
And you met his mother.
I met his mother as well. She was a student at Hawaii, at the University of Hawaii. She was a graduate student. I think she was doing anthropology, and she got some sort of a scholarship or a grant or whatever, and she studied pots or something in Indonesia. But she used to come back and forth all the time and hang out with her son there.
But because he actually, you say in your book, was living with his grandparents, which we know.
Well, the thing about Barry is, and that people say, well, how could you have known him? Well, Honolulu and Oahu is a small place when you take all the tourists away. It's just, there's just only a few people. And so, you know, it was easy to see him there. But, you know, we helped raise him. It wasn't his grandparents so much. It was the people on the island. And I was just one of the people that was pitching in, because everybody kind of knew the situation, that his father had gone, his mother was gone, and he had older grandparents. And so it was a small enough community that after a while you get to know everybody there. And certainly I stuck out because I was what they call a Howley over there. And I had longish hair, and I wore the dress that the people wear over there. And he was even stuck out more than me because he was, Afro-American, which is quite different over there. And so, you couldn't miss the guy. And it was, it was just like two ships passing. That's all it was. I didn't do anything for him very much, and, that he didn't do very much for me. But the one thing that when he became president, I could not believe that kid could become president.
Well, you know what? As I was reading that, it reminded me of a minister here in town. She's retired now, but she said when she was a kid and there would be, a dead bird or something, she would conduct a funeral. And so even from a young age as a kid, she was stepping into that role which she, in adult life, was attracted to. And she was rehearsing things that she did in her adult life by conducting a funeral. And I just saw there was young Barry Obama developing the skills that he would later use as president of the United States, running for president.
He did. He was working on him then. I often equate it to like most kids that age are practicing baseball to become, in their fantasies, playing for the New York Yankees. I think he was only thinking about becoming, president or something. He just related to people in that kind of a fashion. I know what's going on, and you're going to follow me, kind of a thing. And it was quite interesting to see, to be part of that. But I don't know that it influenced me in any way or whatever.
But living in Hawaii did. And what did you, because like I mentioned before, you kind of sum up at the end of a chapter what you gained, how that living experience changed you. And so what did you get from living in Hawaii?
Well, I lived on a couple of different islands. I lived on the island of Oahu, which is where Honolulu is. And that's when I started to, I went back to school. Like I said, Jimmy Carter gave us a GI Bill. And so I went back to school and I really, really learned my
By the way, you were quite complimentary of President Carter. You might put in a good word there.
I just saw him the other day, and it was really interesting. And I didn't know that he did this, but he was a guy that actually brought down Russia because of the arts. He allowed musicians to go over there, and they were just crazy for rock and roll. And then other groups came over, and all the big groups came over, and that's what brought down.
So you're giving credit to Jimmy Carter.
I'm giving credit to Carter, but most of all, I'm giving the credit to the artist, because that's what Kiss of the Art Gods is about, is it that within us there is this gene or whatever that we need art, and and it's part of us, and you're not going to get rid of it, and it's a driving force. And so
President Carter was a facilitator, you're saying?
Yeah, he was a facilitator, and to get people over there. He saw that they would really go for it. He was a brilliant man, and he did a lot for me, and he, I don't know if he got a good rap as president or not, but I certainly like the guy.
My guest is Dan Corbin. He is a successful sculptor, but he's now a memoirist, Kiss of the Art Gods. And I mentioned in your title, you talk about the art gods, and you say in your book that art gods work behind the scenes. And you say when the art gods are working for you, it's simple. One of their unpleasant chores is keeping money in the pockets of artists whom they favor.
I think so. That's the way I explain it.
The art gods, as guardians of humanity, constantly watch out for artists who have discovered the universal art superglue that can bind together and unite society. It's kind of what you were saying.
Dave. Well, that's what I was talking about the Russian thing. You know, united the world. You know, it's rock and roll is something people can agree upon. It doesn't have language or any of that stuff. But I see the art gods as guardians of humanity. In other words, they're there when we're not doing all this war stuff. They're there to help us evolve culturally and societies peacefully. And we do it through the music, through the different arts, through the plays, through the whatever it is, just part of the arts is a way to evolve as a society. So that's the reason I call them the art gods.
And you say art gods are the divine managers of seemingly random connections.
Well, you know, you got to believe in something, you know, and I really went through a lot to get to the point where I could make a living as an artist. And there's so many unique things that happened to me when I finally got my stuff together, you know. So many great coincidences. How do you justify them, or how do you rationalize them? How do you say that was just a coincidence? And so that's it's just a kind of like a faith that I have in a certain way, that if you do it really good and if you're really truthful to yourself, there's someone out there that's going to like it. And if you can do it the best for the feelings that you have inside, and then, you know, I call them the art gods, are going to make the random connections so someone buys it or puts it in their home or speaks about you or introduces you to another person or whatever. There was just too many random, seemingly coincidental events in my life that, you know, it just seems as though there's some sort of a plan out there, even though I don't go in that direction that much.
You know, I thought of Greek and Roman mythology when you talk about these gods that, like the muses, that inspire people. And you're saying that these divine managers just seem to put things together for you and things that seem random.
If you earn it, you have to earn it. You know, and I think that it's, and I kind of think it's that way. I think it's within us, and it's within all of us, this art gene or whatever it is, and that we all are held together by a common consciousness. And so if we can tap into that, that's what I equate it to. So it's still a mystery to me. I just threw that out and kept it as a theme throughout the book and tried to explain it and tried to use science and trying to use, mythology and trying to use Buddhism or whatever to kind of put it all together. It's not really definable, I don't think.
Well, often along the way you mentioned that you are never the same, not these words necessarily, but after this particular event in your life, you were never the same after that. That it changed, and you say that you had a lot of luck in your life, and it's been such a pleasure reading your story, and seeing this whole process of how this little kid from Yuba City on a peach farm grows up to be a successful artist. So, thank you for writing this memoir, Dan.
Well, it was my pleasure, and.
And well, just so people wonder, gosh, this guy went through all his life. Where's this love interest? And you had him along the way, but I might put in a word that you now are the father of three children, and that also is another life changer, isn't it, Dan?
Well, yeah, you know, it's. I was ready for it.
Well, I will look forward to your next chapter in your next book, Dan. My guest has been Dan Corbin. His memoir is Kiss of the Art Gods, a memoir of a sculptor. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.